KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon, and this hour, the Trump administration versus Harvard and vice versa. What Medicaid changes could mean in small towns and what cuts to the National Weather Service could mean this hurricane season. Adam Roberts' new novel, Food Person, about people who really know their shiitake. And a new opera with voices from nonverbal actors, including Jacob Jordan.
When I first heard the sound of my voice come to life, a new realization was born. Dream the bigger dreams, the ones you dismiss and hide away because they seem impossible.
First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, May 24, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. President Trump is overhauling the National Security Council, the foreign policy experts who advise the president. Earlier this month, Trump had replaced the National Security Advisor Michael Waltz with Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Now, dozens of employees were fired yesterday afternoon, some told at 4:30 that they should leave by 5. NPR's Greg Myrie has more.
The NSC has grown over the years. There are periodic calls to scale it back. One of Trump's national security advisors in his first term, Robert O'Brien, recently wrote this in an op-ed. One source, for example, told NPR that the Middle East section at the NSC is being reduced from 10 staffers to 5. So it appears to be an attempt to streamline the national security process, though, again, we don't know precisely because it was done without notice or explanation.
NPR's Greg Myrie. President Trump has signed off on federal assistance for 6 Kentucky counties that were devastated when a deadly tornado hit last weekend. At least 19 people were killed. From member station WUKY, Karen Czar reports.
Just days after Kentucky applied for individual assistance from the federal government, Governor Andy Beshear announced that the request was approved. Despite political differences, Beshear had high praise for the Trump administration following natural disasters.
I disagree with this president on a lot of things, but the FEMA operation on the ground under his administration has been good. In fact, it's been really good.
Beshear anticipates the latest violent storm will, quote, easily be a $100+ million natural disaster. Kentucky is still recovering from storms that hit the state in February and April. For NPR News, I'm Karen Czar in Lexington.
This weekend, Ukraine and Russia are carrying out the largest prisoner of war exchange since Russia's full-scale invasion in February 2022. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports from northern Ukraine, where dozens of families are waiting for buses with 1,000 Ukrainians to arrive by tomorrow.
Anton Kobylnik stepped off the bus draped in Ukraine's blue and yellow flag. The soldier was emaciated and pale after 3 years in Russian captivity. He told NPR he cannot wait to hug his mother. I am finally in Ukraine, he said, but I won't truly feel I'm home until I'm next to my mom in our cottage. Nearby, 18-year-old Milena Moroz holds a photograph of her dad, Yevhen. He disappeared in February of this year. I wish I had told him, I love you, Dad. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Northern Ukraine.
This is NPR News. German police are investigating a knife attack at the central train station in Hamburg yesterday. 18 people were stabbed. Officials say they are in stable condition. A German national was arrested at the scene. Police say it appears the 39-year-old woman had acted alone and there is no indication of a political motive. A judge is to decide whether she should be admitted to a psychiatric ward. The United Nations says it fears 427 Rohingya refugees died at sea while trying to flee Bangladesh and Myanmar. Michael Sullivan reports from Thailand. The agency is still confirming details.
The UNHCR says it believes 2 boats carrying more than 500 Rohingya sank on May 9th and 10th in the Andaman Sea, with fewer than 90 people rescued. the dire conditions in refugee camps in Bangladesh and in Rohingya communities in war-torn Myanmar have led the Rohingya to make the dangerous journey despite the beginning of the annual monsoon rains that make the journey even more treacherous. The fact they'd make the journey during the monsoon, the UNHCR says, reflects the refugees' increasing desperation given recent funding cuts by donor nations, including the U.S. Human rights groups warn more such journeys are likely. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai.
Southeastern France was hit by a major power outage today as the Cannes Film Festival was preparing to hand out its top prize. Officials say about 160,000 homes and businesses lost electricity. The festival says the show will go on. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. There's been another dramatic escalation in the Trump administration's battle with the nation's institutions of higher education. The Department of Homeland Security has moved to bar international students from attending Harvard, the nation's oldest university. Harvard quickly sued. A federal judge yesterday agreed to temporarily block that restriction from the DHS. Laura Meckler is a national education reporter at the Washington Post. She joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Please remind us what led to this face-off.
I mean, it's really been an extraordinary set of events. I mean, I think we can go back to the Trump campaign where President Trump campaigned on going after higher education. He said that universities were hotbeds of anti-Semitism, woke policies, indoctrination, DEI. He called college leaders Marxists, you know, and he promised to go after them. And now he's doing just that, has really unleashed an unprecedented attack on, you know, dozens of investigations of many universities, but pulling grants, pulling contracts. But really, the attack on Harvard has stood out, partly because Harvard has fought back. And there's been just this escalating set of punishments that the administration has unleashed. You know, first, you know, pulling what seems to be every lever that they have, funding, threatening future funding, threatening their tax-exempt status, and then this week saying that foreign students would no longer be eligible to attend.
There are plenty of universities that have a large percentage of foreign students. Why have Harvard and Columbia, among other elite institutions, received what I'll call the special attention of the Trump administration?
Well, you know, it's hard to know exactly why these particular universities have had so much attention. You know, there have been real issues of anti-Semitism at both of these schools, so it's not like there's nothing there. But I do think that, and especially Columbia last year, was really a hotbed of protest activities. It was the epicenter of the pro-Palestinian protest movement. So I think that's partly why Columbia came into the sights. And Harvard, you know, holds a special place in this country, you know, for good or for ill. For many people, they would view this as, you know, an aspirational, you know, wonderful crown jewel of American education. But yet for conservatives, a lot of them view that as just what's wrong with this country.
And how are the universities responding?
You know, there's been just such a mix of responses from universities. Some have just sort of accepted the punishment and then said, you know, relatively smaller amounts of money have been pulled and said that they will just adjust and have had layoffs. Some of them have tried to work things out with Columbia, for instance, has had conversations with the Trump administration, extensive conversations aimed at restoring the funding that had been pulled, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of grants. And Harvard has fought. They have gone to court.
Laura, has there been an effect at other colleges across the country as they look at these events?
Yeah, I mean, colleges are terrified. You know, many of them are facing their own investigations. Dozens of universities have pending investigations. And let's keep in mind, this administration's only a few months old. There's plenty of time for this similar types of actions to happen elsewhere. And people are scared. They're scared that their values are at risk. You know, the policies of diversity and inclusion that universities have embraced are now being told that they're illegal. There's a very big climate of fear right now.
And what are some of the consequences of this ongoing battle between the administration and universities that we could see short term and long term?
Well, I mean, for a place like Harvard, if they, you know, even if they got their money restored, that they've been told they're not going to get any future grants, and they rely on that money to do research in medicine, engineering, science, space, all sorts of subjects. So the question is both consequences for the universities. Can they continue to be the sorts of places that they've been, and also consequences potentially for our country going forward? Are we going to benefit from the knowledge that has been produced by these universities? And, you know, the consequences are just going to continue to unspool as we move through this.
Laura Meckler of The Washington Post, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
House Republicans passed a huge tax and spending bill this week that now heads to the Senate. That legislation includes major changes to Medicaid, the federal health program for low-income people. The cuts lawmakers call for could have major repercussions across the country, especially in rural areas. John Daly with Colorado Public Radio went to the southern part of the state near Great Sand Dunes National Park to learn more about what may be at stake.
The San Luis Valley in south central Colorado. Clouds billow above the towering Sangre de Cristo Mountains as a stiff wind blows. Uncertainty is in the air.
I'm trying to be worried and optimistic.
That's Connie Martin, CEO of San Luis Valley Health in Alamosa. It's the flagship hospital here, serving 50,000 people in six agricultural counties. Any changes to Medicaid could have tremendous ripple effects.
Because Medicaid is such a vital program to rural health care.
Across the hall sits Shane Mortensen, the chief financial officer.
Yeah, the bean counter.
He shows me a spreadsheet with the hospital's annual budget, $140 million. Medicaid payments account for nearly a third of that.
So major Medicaid cuts?
It will be devastating to us. We will have to cut services.
The San Luis Valley has three of the poorest counties in the United States. In one county, 57% of residents are enrolled in Medicaid. It's a lifeline, especially for people who don't have easy access to other coverage, like Juliana Mascarenas.
I looked, you know, into our insurance, and oh my goodness, it's just going to take half my check to pay insurance.
She has six children and says Medicaid has covered her family for years.
Then how do I live? Do I insure my kids or do I keep a roof over their head?
Mascarenas works as an addiction counselor. Her ex-husband farms potatoes and cattle for employers that don't offer health insurance.
So those moments that I was a stay-at-home mom and he's working out agriculture, what would have we even done? We would have had to pay out of pocket.
Or go without. Across the state, Medicaid covers 20% of people, more than a million Coloradans. The hospital has a labor and delivery unit, the kind rural hospitals nationwide have struggled to keep open. But Dr. Carmelo Hernandez, the chief medical officer, worries that cuts could put it in jeopardy.
If we don't have obstetric services here, then where are they going to go? They're going to travel an hour and 20 minutes north to Salida to get health care. Or they can travel to Pueblo, another two-hour drive over a mountain pass, to get health care.
I'm a single mom of four, and I work with kids that have disabilities.
Tiffany Martinez gave birth to her daughter, Esme, earlier this year. The pregnancy was high risk, requiring twice-a-week ultrasounds and stress tests at the hospital. She's enrolled in Medicaid. It's key, she says, for many moms in the Valley.
everything down here is low pay. It's not like we have money to just be able to pay for the doctor. It's not like we have money to travel often to go to the doctor. So it's definitely beneficial.
Republicans in Congress say they want to save money, make government more efficient. Their proposed budget would require people on Medicaid to prove they're working in school or are exempted, but it could force millions of people off Medicaid. In the San Luis Valley, that would mean the hospital and clinics would be treating more uninsured patients with no prospect of reimbursement. Dr. Clint Sowards is a primary care physician. He says leaner hospital finances would make it harder to attract new doctors and nurses.
Especially with needed healthcare services, certain specialties are no longer available. People will have to leave. They will have to leave the San Luis Valley.
Downtown Alamosa has hotels, restaurants, shops, and a coffee house called Roast Cafe. Barista Ethan Bowen makes a specialty drink called a Drooling Moose.
It's a white chocolate mocha with a little bit of caramel in there.
Sounds pretty good.
The coffee shop and brew pub next door does pretty good business, in part because of hospital staff who work nearby.
Oh, a huge part of the local economy.
I met Joe Martinez here. He's president of San Luis Valley Federal Bank.
It's going to hit our community hard.
He says the hospital's regional economic impact is more than $100 million a year. And if more people lose Medicaid coverage, that will hurt banking, small businesses, and their workers.
Very worried as to how it affects the entire economy in the San Luis Valley.
The hospital alone employs 750 people. Next door is Adams State University, the region's next biggest employer. Its president, David Tanberg, told me something most people don't realize.
One of the biggest factors driving state higher education funding down is state spending on health care.
This year, Colorado is facing a $1 billion budget deficit, and universities like his find when state cuts are made, higher education competes with health care for precious funding.
So anytime I hear about Medicaid cuts, it makes me nervous.
And nervous is how many feel right now in the San Luis Valley. For NPR News, I'm John Daly in Alamosa, Colorado.
And that story comes from NPR's partnership with Colorado Public Radio and KFF Health News. Listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Ukraine and Russia exchanged more prisoners of war today, each releasing 307 soldiers. Hundreds of combatants and civilians were brought home yesterday. Meanwhile, the war continues. A Russian attack on Kyiv overnight injured at least 15 people. Monsoon rains arrived in India today, 8 days earlier than usual. They provide nearly 70% of the rain needed to grow crops and replenish aquifers and reservoirs. And a federal judge has blocked the Trump administration from cutting off Harvard's ability to admit foreign students. The school's revocation in the foreign exchange program is now on hold while the matter is being litigated. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. And from Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases, and supporting land conservation initiatives.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. If you're hitting the road this Memorial Day weekend, don't expect a relaxing solitary journey. Tens of millions of people are expected to take at least a short getaway at the start of what's typically a busy summer travel season. This year, many people say they feel shaky about their personal finances, but as NPR's Scott Horsley reports, it doesn't mean they'll stay home all summer.
Deborah Miller runs a historic bed and breakfast in Kane, Pennsylvania, near the Allegheny National Forest. It's a popular destination for folks driving in from nearby Pittsburgh, Buffalo, or Cleveland.
Our land butts up against the national forest. So most of our guests drive up here, you know, to hike or bike or ATV trails around too. People like to do that.
Miller's Inn was busy in the month leading up to Memorial Day, despite some rainy weather, but she's not so sure about the rest of the summer.
Well, I'm looking at June. I feel like we're a little bit down compared to where we were for June for last year. And then July is still looking a little lower, but these things always kind of rectify as you get closer. And we get a lot of, you know, reservations when people just decide to take maybe a short day trip or something. So I'm still hopeful.
Hotel bookings nationwide have been barely growing this spring. But Jan Freitag, who's a travel analyst with the CoStar Group, says that doesn't necessarily spell trouble for the industry. It may just mean that cautious travelers are waiting longer to finalize their plans.
We always like to say uncertainty breeds inaction. And what that means for the leisure traveler is that they're sitting a little bit on their hands.
Surveys suggest there's a lot of uncertainty about the economic outlook. So Freitag says when people do decide to travel, they're often looking to cut corners.
I'm not flying, I'm driving, I'm not staying right on the beach, I'm staying two blocks away from the beach. But most importantly, we are still going.
Aixa Diaz, who's with AAA, expects many travelers will opt for simple road trips this summer rather than far-flung vacations.
They will pack up the car and just go somewhere for the weekend, and perhaps people are staying with family or friends, so it doesn't always have to be an expensive hotel, expensive flight, expensive meals. I mean, people can still travel on a budget.
That's Joanna Leba's strategy. The Wheat Ridge, Colorado residents planning a couple of short camping vacations close to home this summer. But Leba says a flight to Las Vegas or San Diego may have to wait.
I'm kind of manage our family finances, and I'm trying to make sure that we're just saving more. So as a family, we're just trying to buckle down and make sure that we have extra funds in case things get a little tighter going forward.
Leba's husband is close to retirement, so he's been keeping a nervous eye on the volatile stock market. And Leba's worried her own business, consulting for nonprofits, could take a hit this year from government spending cuts.
The economy is just so all over the place and nobody really knows where it's going to land. We are just going to assume it's going to be bad, and if it isn't, we'll be in a great shape, and if it does, we'll be okay.
Industry analysts say wealthy Americans are still spending freely on travel, including to foreign destinations. So far this year, though, the number of foreign visitors to the U.S. is down. That's worrisome to Deborah Miller, the Pennsylvania bed and breakfast owner. Her inn is just a couple hours south of the Canadian border.
I was very concerned because some of the rhetoric coming from Washington, I think, has made Canadians feel unwelcome.
Miller tried to overcome that by sending email coupons to Canadians who visited her in the past.
I got some interesting responses back. Some you probably can't play on your radio show, saying basically we're not coming to America this year or maybe ever.
Still, a handful of Canadian customers took advantage of the coupons to book visits this summer. Miller's hoping for a further thaw in U.S.-Canada relations before the next big travel holiday on the 4th of July. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The Atlantic hurricane season begins on June 1st, and government forecasters predict it may be even worse than usual. It's already been a bad year for tornadoes. Severe storms and tornadoes last week killed more than 24 people in Kentucky, Missouri, and Virginia. The National Weather Service, which is charged with tracking storms and warning the public, is short-staffed after more than 500 workers were cut by the administration's Department of Government Efficiency or left on their own. Brian Lamar was the meteorologist in charge of the Tampa Bay area until last month, when he took an early retirement offer. He joins us now from Tampa. Brian Lamar, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, thank you, Scott. Thanks for having me on the show today.
In your judgment, how serious are these cuts to the important work of the National Weather Service?
Now, the National Weather Service, the mission is protection of life and property. That is the utmost importance. And throughout my career in the National Weather Service, I started over 30 years ago, there's always been staffing challenges that have impacted offices across the country. And when I started, we had between 5,000 and 6,000 people that worked for the National Weather Service. And over the past 10, 20 years, that number has gradually declined to about 4,500. And since January, there's been about 550 people that have either accepted an early retirement, or if they were in their probationary period, a great number of them were let go. So for the first time in the history of the National Weather Service, the agency is below 4,000 people.
We mentioned the deadly storms last weekend. The weather station, as I understand it, covering one of the hardest hit areas, Winston Jackson, Kentucky. They say they were fully staffed at the time, but it's, I gather, one of several offices that has reportedly had to cut overnight hours recently. So had the staffing shortages been in effect then, would lives have been at risk?
It is true. There are 8 offices out of 122 across the National Weather Service that have fallen below a certain level of staffing where it then requires them to not be able to operate 24/7. And the facts are there were people on the overnight shift at the Jackson, Kentucky National Weather Service office. What they did was the day before, they actually had to plan ahead of time to make sure that they had people come into the office. So it was pretty much like an all hands on deck type of mentality. That's how the National Weather Service operates. I remember it throughout my 30-year career. You know, it's basically similar to emergency response, firefighters, medical community, the media, where you are ready to go.
Well, with respect for those conscientious public servants who did the job that was necessary, could that also be an argument that they would do the job with fewer people?
I don't think the current situation is sustainable. So the National Weather Service is putting together plans to really help with this short-term challenge of short staffing. But that's really what it is. It's a Band-Aid on the short-term challenge of that short staffing. The National Weather Service budget costs between $4 and $5 a year per U.S. citizen. It is a very small budget operation for an agency that is charged with 24/7 operations, the protection of life and property, and all of the data. It is the foundation for all of the private sector value-added information. You know, a lot of people think that I can open up my phone and click the weather app and, you know, why do we need the National Weather Service? And so a lot of people, I feel, take it for granted.
You're concerned about whether the National Weather Service is prepared for the hurricane season ahead?
I think the National Weather Service is going to continue to do its mission-driven duty. And I think that's, again, the point. And that's where I get back to with, is it sustainable? Because burnout can happen very easily if there are a high frequency of high-impact weather events. So the National Weather Service is actually creating these mutual aid plans, again, for the short-term fix of this challenge. And what I mean by mutual aid is a group of offices will be working together. So if there's 3 offices and one of them is critically understaffed, then those 2 other offices will be redistributing the workload. And that will allow that short-staffed office to focus on the life-saving mission of issuing warnings, working with elected officials. But again, that's the short-term picture.
Mm-hmm. But it sounds like you don't think that the National Weather Service will fall down or be less prepared or somehow let down the American public.
I don't, because again, being one of them for over 3 decades, failure is not an option. You know, I know that the popular phrase, I've heard it in NASA, it is one that is used by the National Weather Service, but again, it's not sustainable for the long term. And when you have 122 offices, and many of them are short-staffed, 8 of them are critically short-staffed, that right there is a recipe for disaster when you look at the long-range forecast. So again, meteorologists like to forecast the weather. I think we're talking today about forecasting the future of the National Weather Service, and there needs to be a high priority on funding and staffing.
Brian Lamar, a former meteorologist in charge of the National Weather Service in Tampa, now chief meteorologist with the consultancy Inspire Weather. Mr. Lamar, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott. Appreciate it.
This month saw the debut of MSNBC's newest primetime host, Jen Psaki. Now, she is far from the first White House official to emerge from the revolving door as a TV news star. NPR Media correspondent David Folkenflik has this profile.
Jen Psaki became famous delivering briefings and fielding questions as then-President Joe Biden's first press secretary. Here she was sparring with Fox's Peter Ducey in early 2022.
Do you have an alternative suggestion for how they should be tracked?
I unfortunately have not been asked to make U.S. immigration policy.
Today's your moment.
Psaki left the administration, became a pundit, and then became a weekend host for MSNBC. Last June, she faced a crystallizing moment. Just moments after the close of Biden's disastrous debate after then former President Donald Trump, Psaki had to decide how to address what the nation had seen. She played it down the middle.
And it's going to be very consuming for the campaign. Should he be replaced? They're going to be answering that question instead of breaking through on attacking Trump.
10 days later, Psaki assessed Biden's performance in his interview with ABC's George Stephanopoulos. Biden had wanted to regain traction.
I mean, the speculation about Joe Biden's future has been rampant. The panic inside the Democratic Party has definitely not gone away.
Not exactly running defense for her old boss. I spoke with Psaki earlier this month about her aspirations for her new show.
I have points of view. I'm never going to go on television and tell people I don't care about abortion rights. And I have never been asked to be anything but my authentic self here, which I very much appreciate.
She's taking over the 9 p.m. slot Tuesdays to Fridays. And whether it's an interview with Illinois' Democratic governor, Biden's former transportation secretary, Pete Buttigieg, or a segment on Trump's latest outrage, Psaki has questions and thoughts.
The first block of the show is an opportunity to kind of explain to people, talk about what just happened, how it impacts them, what it means for their lives, and who's fighting for them. Because that's always the question people want to know. Like, what are people doing about it? It's not just Trump is bad.
Eric Wemple has picked up on just that. He's the media critic for the opinion pages of The Washington Post. Wemple says Psaki is smart, tough, and appealing, a battering ram, really, against what he sees as the president's offenses against civil liberties, due process, and other core American principles.
She really needs to be on some level an identity person for this huge crowd of liberals who need someone to give them hope.
Even so, when Wemple recently reviewed MSNBC's programming, he came away convinced that the network was failing its audiences by not allowing Trump's allies to make the best case possible and by not challenging Democratic pieties.
On some level, I can understand why MSNBC is where it is, but it's still a terribly monolithic network.
I spoke to Psaki before Biden's announcement that he has advanced prostate cancer and before the release of the book Original Sin by Jake Tapper and Alex Thompson on the failure of Biden administration officials to grapple with his cognitive lapses. Psaki reminded me she left the Biden White House in 2022.
I spent time with him every day, and I'd never seen the person who was on that debate stage.
Psaki says she has seen him once since at a White House holiday party with her daughter.
Now, aging happens quickly. Did it happen aggressively in the year before, the 6 months before, the 4 months before? I don't know the answer to that question.
At my request, researchers at the Internet Archive reviewed the episodes on Psaki's new show. For the record, they found she hasn't brought that insider's insight to her viewers on Biden's health or mental acuity. I asked MSNBC yesterday whether Psaki had any additional comment on the Biden diagnosis or the book, but did not hear back. Psaki has instead been focusing attention on Trump and the threat, she says, he poses. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. President Trump says a genocide of white people, especially Afrikaner farmers, is taking place in South Africa. When he met South African President Cyril Ramaphosa in the Oval Office on Wednesday, the president played a video that had previously been shared on social media by his advisor Elon Musk. Kate Bartlett chased down the details and brings us this report from Johannesburg.
Now this is very bad. These are burial sites right here. Burial sites. Over 1,000 of white farmers.
The video Trump played in the Oval Office showed a road lined on either side with scores of white crosses and a procession of cars carrying mourners paying their respects.
And it's a terrible sight. I've never seen anything like it.
A startled Ramaphosa asked Trump where the location was, saying he'd never seen the video before. South Africa, said Trump. It was indeed a video taken in South Africa, in KwaZulu-Natal province, but it was not a burial site.
My parents, Glenn and Vita Rafferty, were murdered or gunned down by six men on their farm in 2020. So those crosses were erected as a memorial on the day of their funeral.
That's Nathan Rafferty, a white South African. He spoke to NPR from Brisbane, Australia, where he now lives.
That was directed by a local farmer, and then the local community used it as a means of protest and to pay tribute.
Contrary to Trump's claims, no bodies were ever buried along that road, and the white crosses don't mark graves. Asked on Thursday if the president got it wrong, White House Press Secretary Caroline Levitt gave this explanation.
What's unsubstantiated about the video? The video shows crosses that represent the dead bodies of people who were racially persecuted by their government.
The crosses didn't represent a specific number of farm murder victims. They were a symbolic tribute to the murdered couple. During the meeting, Trump also held up a printout of a blog post showing a photo from the Democratic Republic of Congo, mistakenly claiming it was taken in South Africa. Was Rafferty surprised Trump showed the video at the White House?
The last thing you expect to see some of the most traumatic parts of your life shown on international TV. So totally unexpected and obviously opened several new wounds.
The assailants had been planning to rob the couple and wanted to get into their safe. In the end, they only stole their car and a few items of little value. While many murders in South Africa remain unsolved, three of the Rafferty's murderers were tried and two of them were sentenced to life imprisonment. Does Nathan Rafferty believe there's a white genocide happening in South Africa?
Do I think that there's a targeted genocide program of some sort? No, I don't.
However, Rafferty said, despite coming from four generations of farmers, he chose not to follow in their footsteps because of the dangers. He thinks much more needs to be done to prevent and condemn what are sometimes brutal attacks. On Friday, South Africa released its quarterly crime statistics. These are not usually broken down by race, but given Trump's attacks, police said they were making an exception. From January to March 2025, six people were killed on farms in South Africa, police said. Out of those six, one was white. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
This is NPR News.
After George Floyd's murder 5 years ago, black families yet again had to warn their sons about the very real danger of racism.
My fear was solidified.
Am I going to be having this conversation 30 years from now? When is it going to stop?
A father and son talk about the talk. Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. President Trump is cutting back the National Security Council. The foreign policy experts who advised the president, several members were fired yesterday. Some said they received the notice at 4:30 p.m. and told to vacate the office by 5. Syria today welcomed the Trump administration's easing of sanctions to help that country recover from a 14-year civil war. The sanctions had been aimed at isolating Syria's previous rulers. And French authorities suspect arson caused a fire at an electrical substation near Cannes overnight. This morning, a power outage affected 160,000 customers. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Cunard, offering travelers an opportunity to voyage aboard Cunard's Queen Elizabeth to Alaska. Guests can experience Glacier Bay National Park and Hubbard Glacier, as well as locally sourced cuisine. Learn more at Cunard.com. And from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. And as BJ Lederman, who writes our theme music, tells us, it's time for sports. NBA playoffs, Pacers shine. Caitlin Clark goes for the champs, Indy 500. Rawr, rawr, rawr. And Michelle Steele of ESPN joins us now from Indiana. Indiana, USA, the mighty capital of the sports world this weekend. Thanks for being with us, Michelle.
Good morning, Scott.
NBA Conference Finals. We'll note in the West, Oklahoma City Thunder is up 2-0 against Minnesota Timberwolves. The Indiana Pacers in the East, 2-0 against the New York Knicks. Defeated them last night, 114-109 at Madison Square Garden. The Knicks were riding high last week, but all their celebrity fans have to be just a little hangdog now, don't they?
Yeah, you know what? I'm saving my sympathies for Timothy Chalamet and Ben Stiller and Spike Lee and everyone else, because they've got it pretty good in New York. But you're right, they are down 2-0 in this series. And it's been an exciting series, you know. The Knicks cut the lead to just one last night with under 15 seconds left, but it wasn't enough. Pascal Siakam led Indiana with 39 points. That's a playoff career high for him. The big question is around New York Knicks head coach Tom Thibodeau. Does he trust his bench? It's become a cliche in the NBA, but the Knicks starting five, Scott, has played more minutes than any other lineup in the league, and if they don't make adjustments, they could very well cost themselves a trip to the finals, because guys are starting to look gassed.
Now, you are at the scene of where Caitlin Clark and the Indiana Fever and the WNBA are going to take on defending champ New York Liberty. For all the excitement around Caitlin Clark and all of her achievements, she hasn't won a championship. What is this game going to tell us?
I've talked to people around this team, and I can tell you that they see this matchup this afternoon as a measuring stick. This could be a finals preview. It's their biggest battle so far. The Liberty are the defending champs, and they look like it so far. They're undefeated this season. Caitlin Clark and the Fever are gunning for no less than a championship this season, Scott, but she's looking for a little bit of a bounce back performance. In the last game, she did not make a single three-point shot. That's the first time that's happened to her in the pros, but the good news is she's got some veteran help who's stepping up.
Indy 500 is tomorrow, and against expectations, Robert Schwartzman of Israel won the pole position and will start in first place. What do you expect from tomorrow's race?
You know, Schwartzman is a rookie, too, so that's kind of an exciting storyline. But the storyline, the scandal even, that people have really been watching involves a driver named Joseph Newgarden, and he drives for Team Penske, which, of course, is one of the most successful organizations in racing. And the trouble started when they found that Newgarden's car had illegal modifications to a safety part, and they found out that the same illegal modifications were on his car from his winning race earlier this year. And so he's going for a third straight Indy 500 win. likely not going to happen because some of the penalties he's facing include starting from the back of the pack, and no driver starting from the final row has ever won the Indy 500. We'll see if he can do it, but certainly the odds are against him.
And some sad news. Jim Irsay, owner of the Indianapolis Colts, died Wednesday. He was 65. He presided over one of the most successful eras in the history of the team, and also very openly struggled with alcoholism, drug addiction, and was not only open about it, he helped fund a lot of programs to help others. How do you see his legacy, Michelle?
I think that's such a huge part of his legacy because there are so many people, not just in sports, but outside sports, who are afraid to open up about vulnerabilities, who are afraid to open up if they're dealing with health challenges. Not Jim Irsay, you know, he did have those issues with addiction and with mental health that he was struggling with, and he was open about it. And I think that dedication to helping others, Scott, you know, through his own struggles and the influence that he used, not just to put out a winning football team out there, but for a cause that really touches a lot of lives, I think that's going to leave his most lasting impact beyond the football field. But very sad. I'm sure there'll be a moment of silence at the Fever and the Pacers games this weekend, and a lot of people in Indy certainly thinking about Jim Irsay.
Michelle Steele, thanks so much.
You bet.
Isabella Pasternak loses her job at an online food magazine when she mucks up a chocolate souffle on Instagram Live. On the rebound, she's offered the opportunity to write, that is, to ghostwrite, a cookbook for Molly Babcock, an actor with a reputation for bad behavior and a career in need of a reboot. But does Molly have any recipes for food or for life? Food Person is the debut novel from Adam Roberts, a food writer himself who joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott. This is really cool.
It's cool for us. At first glance, this doesn't seem like such a promising partnership, does it?
No, Molly is a celebrity who does not like food, and Isabella is as passionate about food as anyone is passionate about anything. Her whole life is food, you know, and it's somewhat autobiographical because even right now as I'm sitting here talking to you, I'm thinking about what I'm going to have for lunch. So some people are just built that way where food is their priority. And Isabella, she just loves cooking and she loves collecting cookbooks, and cookbooks are her passion, which is sort of what sets up the conflict with Molly, because Molly doesn't care about cookbooks nearly as much as Isabella does.
Molly has her reasons for not being warm about food, doesn't she?
Yes. You know, in writing this book, I try to push past the idea of the shallow celebrity who doesn't eat and doesn't like food. I wanted to understand, why does this character Molly resist the idea of actually cooking and eating? And halfway through the book, there's a revelation that you find out that her mother was a passionate home cook and had a collection of recipes. So that sort of unlocks her character a bit and helps us get deeper into the story.
Family recipes can open family histories, and that can be complicated, can't it?
Yeah, family recipes. I mean, there are stories that go with those recipes, and oftentimes the stories are better than the recipes. You know, I think a lot of us have things that our parents made or our grandparents made. My mother-in-law makes a lasagna with cottage cheese, and I think that's very common around the country. But, you know, as the food culture has grown and grown, you'll see more and more quote-unquote authentic lasagnas with ricotta cheese. But for my partner, like, eating it with cottage cheese is so sentimental and emotional. So I think that there's a lot of psychology that goes into the food that we eat and the way we think about the food that we eat.
That sounds good, actually.
Yeah, I think it's a good substitute.
I wonder what food writers do you admire, and have they influenced you?
Oh, I have so many. I mean, first and foremost, I would say Calvin Trillin. Actually, he wrote a book a couple of years ago called Feeding a Yen, and that was the first food book I ever read where it was really funny. And I thought, wow, you can be funny about food, because so much food writing is self-serious, and I love that he didn't take himself too seriously. And I love him. I love Ruth Reichel. I love MFK Fisher. I mean, you name it, I love him.
And Isabella notes that the really great food writers, it's not just recipes to them, right? It's a peek into their lives.
Absolutely. You know, the very first essay of Calvin Trillin's that I read was about his daughter going away to college and saying she would only come back to New York if he could track down the pumpernickel bagel that she loved growing up. That story, you know, it's as much as it's about food, that's about so much more. It's about a father losing his daughter to the wider world, wanting her to come home. And I think we wrap up so much emotion in these stories about food. And even when you go to a restaurant and they describe a dish and they say, this dish comes from the chef's grandmother who escaped, you know, World War II, it makes it taste different to hear the story before you eat it. So I think it's really important.
We should reveal, without revealing too much, that Molly and Isabella do learn from each other, don't they?
Mm-hmm. My starting point was that Isabella was very withdrawn and disconnected from people. You know, the opening of the whole book, it talks about how she brings cookies to work every day that she can hand out to people so she doesn't have to talk to them.
Yeah.
Molly, on the other hand, is extremely extroverted, over the top, loves attention, loves being in the limelight, but is not necessarily thoughtful. And so these two women, through cooking together, sort of are forced to kind of change. And then I really try to build the story so that the kitchen was the locus of all that change.
You are reminded, and maybe, I don't know if this fell into your design or not, food has a way of unlocking us and can open us up to each other, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, just the concept of breaking bread. Most of these things happen at the table when we're eating. And I think it's because we're vulnerable when we're eating. It's a bodily thing. You know, you're putting food into your body. It's very intimate. So to do that in somebody else's company is very relationship forming. And I think that's why, you know, you go on a date usually to a restaurant and you share food together. And there's a lot of emotional transactions that happen at the table. And I think that there's so many books about that. There's one called Life is Meals. And I think that's pretty much true.
I do not ask this of every first-time novelist. Can we have a recipe?
Okay, my favorite recipe comes from Lydia Bastianich, and it's cavatappi with sun-dried tomatoes and cannellini beans. And you make it by sautéing garlic and sun-dried tomatoes and olive oil with chili flakes. Then you drop cavatappi into a pot of boiling salted water. Then you take the pasta water and you add it to the pan with the tomatoes and the garlic, and it kind of makes a sauce, and then you add white beans to that, and then you add the pasta and Parmesan cheese, and it's truly, I mean, I make it all the time. It's my favorite pasta dish.
Adam Roberts, his debut novel, Food Person. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Scott. This was a real pleasure.
The new opera in Omaha not only presents disability as a theme, it presents disabled singers and actors on stage front and center. Two of those cast members are nonverbal. Jeff London reports that the production worked for 5 years to develop technology to give them voice.
If you remember physicist Stephen Hawking, he used a special speech synthesizer to let him express himself. Jacob Jordan uses similar technology.
It is great to be here. As someone who was not able to fully communicate for the first 22 years of my life, it is mind-blowing to be in an opera and to be here sharing on NPR.
But as part of that new opera, Sensorium X, Jordan, now 23, uses technology developed by a lab at NYU that makes his voice less robotic, more expressive.
When I first heard the sound of my voice come to life, a new realization was born. Dream the bigger dreams, you know, the ones you dismiss and hide away, because they seem impossible.
Even though it might still sound a little stilted, a little synthetic, it's not perfect, it's them, right? It sounds like them.
Luc Dubois is co-director of the NYU Ability Project. He and a team of technology professors and grad students developed an AI interface to let Jacob Jordan and the castmate he alternates with, Kader Zuesh, speak in the opera.
We had this, you know, pretty profound eureka moment. It was like very emotional in the room. Everybody was like, oh my God, because it no longer sounds like their off-the-shelf commercial speech synthesizer. It sounds like they're talking.
This all came about because composer Paola Prestini was commissioned to write an opera and collaborated with librettist Brenda Shaughnessy, who has a nonverbal son. They developed a dystopian sci-fi story and cast the piece with disabled performers. One singer has cerebral palsy, a couple of others are blind, and one character is nonverbal, says Prestini.
You know, I had a challenge. How do you bring a nonverbal character to life?
You know, how do you bring a nonverbal character to life in an opera where everything is about voice?
Paola Prestini wanted the nonverbal character to not only be a stage presence, so she approached Luc Dubois, who, in addition to running a technology program at NYU, is a composer, and asked him to develop a device to allow this character to speak. In addition, Prestini says,
and we both agreed that it would be open source so that by the time we finished the opera, that this would actually really be something that anybody in the nonverbal or minimally speaking community could use.
It was a 5-year process. The first 2 years were spent surveying the nonverbal community to find out what they wanted and needed from such a device.
There's this mantra that, you know, everybody in this community uses, which is nothing about us without us.
And then Dubois and his team set about developing sophisticated technology that combines sampling of the sounds the two nonverbal actors make using AI to give them expressive voice. They also created devices to allow the two of them to control those expressions on stage. Dubois says these gizmos
are repurposed time of flight sensors, and sometimes you call it LIDAR. So these are the sensors that you have on your automobile that help you park or know when you're about to get hit by another car. They're collision detection modules. They're about $3.
And by waving his hand over these little modules, Dubois demonstrates how Jacob Jordan can manipulate the pre-recorded sound of his voice.
Moving my hand over one of them will trigger
it. I am me.
And then the other two,
I am me,
will let me slow it down.
I
and speed
am
up.
Me.
Right?
I am me.
These devices can even generate some of Jordan's other sounds, whistles and hums.
They can also do it with their own natural vocalizations, which we've sampled. So, you know, Jacob can play and bend his whistles.
Jacob Jordan says,
they took our sounds and incorporated them into our performances, so each showing will be a unique experience that reflects us. Thank you for hearing our voices.
The opera premieres at the Common Sense Festival in Omaha, which focuses on arts, science, and disability acceptance. And everyone involved is hoping the technology can be picked up and developed to provide voice to people who, for whatever reason, cannot speak. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, at macfound.org.